Hello there, Monica Reinagel, the Nutrition Diva here. We have a little something extra for you this week in addition to our regular weekly episode. Last week, I joined Tom Hall on WYPR, that's my local NPR station here in Baltimore, for a segment on Midday, that's his daily news and current events show. And Tom had asked me to come in to talk with him about a big announcement by the White House of an additional $1.7 billion commitment to their ongoing campaign to reduce hunger and food insecurity in the United States. We had a great conversation about the factors that contribute to food insecurity, the private-public partnerships that have come together to address this. We talked about food as medicine, food dignity, and how you can most effectively support these efforts. And I thought you might like to hear what we were talking about. So, with the gracious permission of Baltimore Public Media and WYPR-FM in Baltimore, we are including an edited version of that show as a bonus for Nutrition Diva listeners. Enjoy.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall, and today it's another edition of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. Monica is a licensed nutritionist, an author, and a speaker. She's also the host of the Nutrition Diva podcast and the Change Academy podcast, which focuses on the art and science of behavior change. Yesterday, Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff announced a new initiative by the Biden administration to address hunger. Mr. Emhoff announced a $1.7 billion program to promote healthy eating and to make healthy food more accessible. According to the Food Research and Action Center, one in eight households, or nearly 13% of families in the United States, experiences food insecurity, or they don't have access to nutritional, affordable food. In an interview on CNBC, Gary Pilnick, the CEO of cereal giant Kellogg's, said that one solution to the affordability dilemma is to eat cereal for dinner. Pan-roasted Frosted Flakes with a champagne basil cream sauce, anybody? Monica Reinagel joins me today in Studio A. It's good to see you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
So let's talk a little bit about the White House's approach to hunger. The $1.7 billion that Mr. Emhoff announced yesterday is in addition to $8 billion or something that they allocated towards what President Biden's calling the challenge. What is the challenge?
To reduce hunger, to increase access to nutritious foods. And we should say that this $1.7 billion that they were talking about yesterday isn't all money that the government is spending. This represents commitments that they have gotten other stakeholders to make, for-profit corporations, nonprofits, government agencies. So they're really trying to build a multi-level, multi-dimensional approach and to involve more than just government agencies in this work.
Yeah, we're a rich country. We've got a lot of rich people. We've got a lot of people who, you know, don't give a second thought to whether or not they have a meal to look forward to at the various times of day. But there's a lot of people who struggle. I mean, they open that refrigerator and there's nothing in it. And they open that cupboard and there's nothing in it.
I think this is really a very misunderstood phenomenon in our society. And you'll notice they also have a lot of star power behind this initiative. They have Jose Andres, very famous chef, also involved in a lot of humanitarian efforts around food, and the Harlem Globetrotters and other sports and entertainment figures. And I think that is really in an effort to increase awareness of this issue because, as you said, one in eight households is experiencing food insecurity, and that doesn't count the households that are really just one paycheck, one health crisis, one really expensive car repair away from suddenly not being sure how or whether they're going to put food on the table. And I think one of the reasons this is a little invisible is because it might not be obvious to you which of your neighbors may be suffering from food insecurity. You can't tell by looking at someone.
Yeah, you think, oh, if someone's hungry, you know, she's probably skinny and, you know, malnourished. Not always the case.
Yeah, actually, it can be the opposite. My neighborhood association is always trying to campaign to get the potholes on our street filled. And then as soon as the street is smooth, they want to have speed bumps put in. And I always think, half jokingly, well, the potholes were actually doing a pretty good job at keeping the speed down. But that's a joke. But I think sometimes people apply the same false logic to this. We have a big obesity problem in this country. We have a food insecurity problem. And there's a big overlap in those populations. And someone might think, like, well, there's your solution. If you don't have enough food, maybe that'll address the epidemic of obesity. Not at all the case. Some of the behaviors that can contribute to overweight and obesity may actually be a response to food insecurity.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. It's Smart Nutrition here on Midday. So you mentioned the Harlem Globetrotters are part of this effort. There's some 14 sports leagues and stuff, and they're going to talk about integrating physical activity into, you know, daily routines for folks, especially kids. I was taken by some of the initiatives around educating medical students, people who are studying to be doctors, about nutrition. This was interesting. There are a couple of different companies that medical schools bring in. I mean, they outsource nutrition education in med school. It's not doesn't seem to be part of the regular curriculum in a lot of med schools. That's really interesting. I mean, as a nutritionist, I wonder what your reaction to that is.
Well, that's been long been a complaint about medical training and education, is the docs are not getting good education in nutrition, and yet people are still looking to doctors for that kind of guidance. Now, we do have an entire other profession of nutrition and dietetics where people are getting that training, and I'd love to see those two professions teaming up and working together. But in the meantime, it's a move in the right direction to be including more basic nutrition information in the medical curriculum for doctors so that they can recognize when they are looking at someone who may be food insecure, who may not be getting regular, adequate nutrition, that would be more obvious to them. They might even just be more sensitized to the prevalence of this problem.
Yeah, and just to understand that, you know, perhaps change in diet or, you know, improving the diet could obviously help, you know, with whatever medical problems they're encountering. But you've written extensively about something I never knew was a thing. It's the medicine, you know, food as medicine movement. This notion that if you just eat the right things, you got clear sailing. Not so much.
Right. And this is being largely driven by physicians, by medical doctors who recognize the importance of diet and other lifestyle as being a key determinant of long-term health. And I think that this movement is well-intentioned, you know, by making people aware that the choices that they're making has such a big impact on their risk of certain long-term chronic conditions. If that inspires people and motivates people to make healthier choices, great. My concern about the food as medicine movement is that it overlooks the fact that we don't all have the same access to those healthy choices. And, you know, we need to address some of the accessibility issues before we can start insisting that people take control and take responsibility for their health. That's a lot easier for people who have a kitchen to cook in and are not food insecure and have all the resources, the time, the skills, the know-how to use food as quote-unquote medicine. And the other concern I have with this is that it creates the impression that if you do end up suffering from some sort of condition, then maybe it's your fault because you didn't make the right choices.
You have heart disease because of what you ate. Yeah.
Right. That's not only untrue, because you can do all the right things and still end up with type 2 diabetes, with heart disease, with cancer. It's also supremely unhelpful for someone to feel guilty or ashamed or to be stigmatized for what we refer to as lifestyle diseases. We kind of build it right into the description there. So those are some of my concerns with the lifestyle as medicine movement. I respect what they're trying to accomplish. I just want to temper it with a little bit more sensitivity to just how complex these issues are.
You wrote, and this was a revelation to me, there's actually a study where doctors were prescribing produce. They were like writing scripts for produce, you know? So instead of, you know, take three Tylenols or something. They're saying go buy three crowns of broccoli. And they did a study about that.
Right.
But the study had perhaps some counterintuitive conclusions.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the apotheosis of the food as medicine movement, right? We're going to write scripts for vegetables. What it did expose was that that is just one piece of the puzzle, and there are a lot of other pieces in the puzzle that need to be in place for people to consistently make those healthy choices. So we're going to have to do a little bit better than just writing cute prescriptions for fruits and vegetables, or even, you know, there's big efforts to try to address what we call food deserts, where if you're shopping at a grocery store, Tom, you may be making a choice to buy fresh vegetables instead of potato chips. But if a convenience store is the only place that you can buy groceries for your family, that's not really as available a choice for you.
Sure. There are so many food deserts here in Baltimore.
There are. And we should be continuing to try to address that. But again, even irrigating the food deserts with more accessible grocery stores, one piece of the puzzle. We still need to make sure that people have the space and the equipment that they would need to cook at home, that people may not necessarily have cooking skills. They may not know what to do with that fresh produce when they get home. There's a, you know, there's a hurdle that has to be overcome in acquiring an appreciation and an enjoyment of these foods. So yeah, it's that's a piece of the puzzle. But what I appreciate about this commitment, this program that the White House is championing here, is that they really are looking at this in a very multifactorial way and trying to get a lot of those pieces to fall a little bit more into place so that we can make some traction on this. As you said, it is absurd that a country with our resources has 1 in 8 households not quite sure whether they're going to be able to put a meal on the table every day this week.
Yeah. And part of the initiative has an organization called Food Forward, which is a produce recovery company. So they take produce that otherwise is going to be discarded, and they make sure it gets into homes of people who need it.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because one of the other ironic pieces of this puzzle is the amount of food that we throw away.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a third or so of the food that we produce in this country ends up in the trash. And that's not only a shame in terms of what that could be doing to address hunger, it's also a real environmental concern, because the methane that is produced as organic scraps and food break down in our landfills is a major contributor to greenhouse gases. We know we can't really afford to be stoking that particular fire. So creative efforts to redirect good food that is otherwise on its way to the landfill for reasons like there's no place to store it, or, you know, too much in the wrong place. Trying to capture that and make that more available and reduce food waste is another really important part of this puzzle.
Yeah. I remember years ago, our good friend John Shields was talking about the farm-to-table movement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the barriers for restaurants was that people had an expectation, and this is literally years ago, so 10, 12, 15 years ago, I don't know how long ago, they had problems if a restaurant served, you know, like red potatoes that all weren't, you know, the perfect golf ball size. You know, if there's a red potato that's at all malformed, it was an outrage, and restaurants were reluctant to actually serve that food. And it took a while to, educate the public to say, you know, the red potato that looks a little weird is just as good as the red potato that's a perfect cylinder.
Or even better, because it came from a nearby farm.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So it's, you know, part of it is what consumers expect and require. And I do, in that regard, I want you to comment on what folks are calling the Marie Antoinette moment of the fellow who is the CEO.
That's what I've been calling it anyway.
the CEO of the Kellogg's Corporation, the big cereal manufacturer, a guy named Gary Pilnick. He did an interview on CNBC about an ad campaign, and I've actually seen one of these commercials, where Kellogg's is encouraging people, well, don't cook tonight. Give the chickens a night off. Have cereal for dinner, you know? And people like you and others are comparing it to the let them eat cake, comment by Marie Antoinette. But it turns out It's not a completely horrible idea.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. I'm sure he wished he could have taken that back. But it obscures the fact that there's some truth to this, especially in this discussion that we're having today about food insecurity. Cereal turns out to be, it's a highly fortified food. And that makes it one of the chief delivery systems for several nutrients that we're concerned about, that people are regularly not getting enough of.
And we're talking about cereals like Frosted Flakes and Mini Wheats and stuff.
Right.
There are tons of sugar, too. But, right?
But they can be a very significant source of these nutrients, and not just any old nutrients, but what we call nutrients of concern. And they play an even bigger role in supplying those nutrients in lower-income households. And, you know, they're very cost-effective way to address some nutrient shortfalls. About 85%, I think, of ready-to-eat cereal is consumed with milk, which is another really important delivery mechanism. Calcium, vitamin D. It can be the primary source of milk in kids' diets. So, yes, cereal actually can play a role here in the fight against hunger, in the fight against food insecurity and malnutrition by delivering a lot of nutrition for not much money in a way that most people do find accessible and palatable.
Yeah. People studied this and they found that people, you wrote about this, if they eat ready-to-eat cereals like Cheerios, Frosted Flakes, that kind of thing, they generally have a higher intake of vitamins A, D, calcium, iron, fiber, and other nutrients. So it ain't all bad.
Well, you know, we're in this moment right now where we've demonized processed foods and ultra-processed foods as being the root of all evil, and we're taught to shop the perimeter of the grocery store, which is where all the healthy food supposedly hangs out. And ready-to-eat cereal, not on the perimeter of the grocery store, but certainly can play a valuable role in meeting nutrient needs.
Yeah, and it's a matter of, you know, offsetting the downside of the Frosted Flakes with all the sugar and stuff. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, if it's the only thing you're eating for dinner, you know.
It's not a complete
six
diet.
6 nights in a row, that's
for
not
sure.
A good idea.
Yeah. Right. But I have to confess, I had that bias about the sugar-sweetened breakfast cereals, too, that the sugar more than offset any valuable nutrition. And I was a little bit surprised to see what a small proportion of added sugars those cereals, even the sweetened ones, end up contributing to the overall diet. They're not a major source of sugar in the diet in practice, and they are a major source of nutrition. So I've had to kind of reel that in a little bit. If you can sell plain Cheerios to your toddler, go for that, you know.
Right.
But if you can't, we shouldn't be discarding this out of hand.
Monica Reinagle is the host of the Nutrition Diva podcast and the Change Academy podcast, which focuses on the art and science of behavior change. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Tom.